Yeah, no, the Lord is not a sex fiend, as men count sex fiends. However, he is a bloodthirsty killer. The Lord commands the men of Israel to slay the Midianites. This they do with gusto, killing every man, plundering and pillaging, taking for slaves all the women and children. However, when they return to camp, Moses isn't happy. "Have you allowed all the women to live?" he asks them. "Kill every male among the little ones, and kill every woman who has known a man by sleeping with him. But all the young girls who have not known a man by sleeping with him, keep alive for yourselves." That's Moses' directions, translating for God, in Numbers 31, 1 through 18.
What a barbaric tome. The Bible, I knew it was. I knew it was kind of a little bit, you know, strange. And I knew it had been tampered with for over the many, like, 5,000 years, over the last 5,000 years. People had changed a lot of stuff. And also, a lot of it had nothing to do with the laws of biblical laws and stuff like that, but rather just how to make a sandwich.
Here's another good one. There's a lot about how to make a sandwich and what happens if you do it wrong. If men get into a fight with one another and the wife of one intervenes to rescue her husband from the grip of his opponent by reaching out and seizing his genitals, you shall cut off her hand. Show her no pity. That's in Deuteronomy 25.
How you find that?
It is. This is all quotes. These are real quotes from the Bible, okay? Duh. I can't believe that you're surprised.
They're all so goofy. They're all goofy.
I was raised by a Bible expert, Dave. Captain Hugh M. Smith was really a Bible expert. And I inherited all his books about the Bible.
Yes.
Now, his take on it, after he'd been studying its history for years, is that it's all fiction from top to bottom. And he taught Bible studies at the Methodist Church in Glen Rose for 20 years.
Yes, carefully placing seeds of doubt into the minds of the growing people there.
Yeah, he would read him stuff like that. So you just think about that. They considered him quite a character. Dave, it's getting nigh on to the end of show.
I'm sorry.
And that means it's time for us to say that they're listening to the Hour of Slack. And people who are interested in learning more about the Bible, or the Bauble, as we might call the book of the subgenius,
can go bugger off.
They can check off to subgenius.com. And Dave's book, Neighbor World, is on sale there, although...
It's a beautiful book.
I'm not supposed to... Anyway,
you're just
somebody bought a copy of Neighbor World today.
It is available there.
Yes. Somebody bought a copy of Neighbor World today.
All right.
Well, they should be buying one every day.
Every
I'm rather
minute.
Surprised because I know
minute,
who
every
has
week,
bought
every
one.
Hour.
That means I know who hasn't bought one.
Mm-hmm.
I've been kind of surprised at who hasn't
Me too.
Bought one.
Who hasn't bought one? I want to know.
You name them.
The ones that we give as gifts, people love them when they get one as a gift.
Hey, it's time to end the show and feed the dog her pill. And I get a pill. The dog gets a pill and I get a pill. They're both wrapped in peanut butter so that we...
Of the battle was not permissible.
The BBBBCCC.
On Monday, EU leaders will gather at a meeting hosted by PR News.
PR News.
Bob is claiming this is PR. In Boston, PR's Gay Bob reports some Bobs are upset about gay pride.
Saying that more people means more potential for gay pride and brutality. Less potential, not more.
So, welcome to another edition of Bathrobe Spears Broadsides, coming at you on the stream of free radio at freakradio.org, archived and live, if you happen to be watching or listening, I should say, on the 23rd of May, 2019. Not quite sure what I'm going to be putting up today, except kind of interviews, possibly a bit from Justin Cummings' colloquy with the Santa Cruz neighbors, which was about a week ago. And there was no meeting with the West Side neighbors on Tuesday, as we thought. They postponed it until the 28th. For all of you West Side neighbor fans who want to get in on their strategy for driving away RVs, it should be, if they don't postpone it again, on the 28th of May, Tuesday, at the Santa Cruz community room of the police station at 5 o'clock. So I'll be checking in again on Sunday to see if that's the case. But you have to check in, too. I suggest you contact your friendly local police department and ask them if their room is booked for Tuesday at 5 o'clock on the 28th by the West Side neighbors, because they're the ones that supposedly are doing it. And the police department has been reasonably accurate in giving me that kind of information in the past. A year or two ago was National Police Week, and there was a photo on, I don't know if it's Andy Mills' Facebook page or Take Back Santa Cruz's Facebook page, but it had Andy Mills, chief of police, some of his lieutenants like Martinez and other high-ranking officers, and a sort of a fond embrace, well, a friendly lineup, with Annalisa Cube, the head of Take Back Santa Cruz. I should say at least the co-founder. I assume she's still with that group. And I mention it because the police department doesn't have the right to associate with whoever they want, and Annalisa Cube doesn't have the right to associate with the police. They all do. Nor is anyone guilty of anything other than the fact that Take Back Santa Cruz is a notorious group for its anti-homeless legislative agenda, which it has pressed, and the people it has elected, Hillary Bryant, Lynn Robinson, Rochelle Narayan, backing, I don't know if they've actually endorsed Cynthia Matthews. They certainly should have if they haven't already. She was Take Back Santa Cruz before it was Take Back Santa Cruz. All these folks together on a sort of a public, I'd say kind of on the public dime, because when the mayor has a proclamation about National Police Week but refuses to have a proclamation about Food Not Bombs' 39th anniversary, which is coming up tomorrow for all you folks, I want to remind you, check out the Resource Center for Nonviolence at 610 Ocean Street at 6 o'clock and going till 10, and who knows, maybe later. It's a party and a street party. It's doors will be opening at 6, as I said. There's a suggested donation of $5 to $20, but no one turned away for lack of money, which is, of course, very Food Not Bombs-ish. DNA, Gina Rene, Danny Paul Nelson, Roberta Perala, The Raging Grannies, and Lyrical Eye, at least I recognize the last two, will be playing there. It's going to be celebrating 9 years of feeding social movements and the hunger and the Hungry at the Soupstock Festival, as they're calling it. That's tomorrow, May 24th. And last time, the 20th anniversary, I guess that was 19 years ago, drew nearly 20,000 people, according to this advertisement on IndieBay.org or announcement. And I'll be reading a little bit more from their blurb for Soupstock 2019, which you can also find on Facebook as we get into the show. So stay tuned for that and my usual round of caustic commentary. There is a shitty council meeting coming up on Tuesday, as well as a Board of Stupid Vipers meeting, supervisors, if you will. This council comes up in the afternoon and evening, assuming they're having an evening session. And the supervisors comes up, starts at 9 usually in the morning on Tuesday, goes until 4 or thereabouts. But we don't have the agenda until Friday usually, so I can't really tell you much about that, though I may be back on Sunday in my 9:30 show to give you more information. So let's get into it.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you.
So let's begin by jumping to Berkeley, because we haven't been there much in the last few shows. I'm going to be quoting from a story that I picked up off the internet, actually a couple of them, about an ongoing trial that's happening up there around the group First They Came for the Homeless. The Courthouse News Service, and the headline is, Berkeley denies mistreating homeless as retaliation for protests. And actually, one of the witnesses was our old friend, if you've been following these broadcasts, Mike Zint, who is one of the founders of First They Came for the Homeless, which developed out of the Occupy San Francisco group way back in 2011 and began traveling around Berkeley half a dozen years later as part of the poverty tour, where they essentially would go to a park, set up their camp, their tents, be there as long as they could. When the police came to remove them, although there were no adequate shelters in Berkeley and still aren't, they would sometimes lose their property, sometimes take their property with them, move to another park, another green area, another median space between two roads, set up camp, similar to what was done with Dignity Village up in Portland, Oregon. And ultimately, they found themselves on the edge of town at where Adeline Street hits Oakland, and they set up camp there, and they were left alone for almost a year. Then harassed again. The city actually put in a porta potty after much pressure from them and from other members in the community. But recently, the city has begun enforcing anti-homeless laws against them. And this is actually, the lawsuit is a follow-up from police action against First They Came for the Homeless several years ago, which they claim violates their First Amendment rights. They claim they were being harassed not for camping, but because of their protests against the city's policies, which were to drive the homeless out of sight and out of town, like in Santa Cruz. Here's some more of that story. And it's from San Francisco Courthouse News. The city of Berkeley targeted homeless campers because they settled in disruptive locations, smeared feces on City Hall, and wrote suicide messages on sidewalks. Not because they were protesting City Hall policies, a city attorney told jurors Monday. Now, you may remember the city attorneys are the people that defend indefensible policies in cities against poor and homeless people. And you saw this most recently, if you've been following Santa Cruz politics, with Reed Galagly, who is the assistant city attorney, or one of them, in Santa Cruz. And he lied on the stand, along with Susie O'Hara, regarding adequate shelter spaces, or tried to mislead the community around that issue. And then he attempted to smear one of the council members who testified otherwise, and also testified in favor of, and actually gave a declaration in favor of, those who wanted to stop the Ross camp from being destroyed so that people would not be flooding into the community all over the place with no shelter, which is what the city authorities under city manager Martine Bernal was trying to do, and effectively did a couple of weeks ago, essentially creating space for about 60 of them over at the River Street, very expensive barbed wire boneyard encampment, and letting a few folks into the 7th Avenue winter shelter, which was extended until June 30th, as was the River Street campground. And then also for families and for women and children, the Laurel Street. And all that amounted to maybe 120 spaces, maybe a little more, if you assume that everybody else gets kicked out or excluded, which, and since there are 1,000 to 2,000 homeless people in Santa Cruz, a figure that I imagine is familiar to most of you listening, at least you know that's my figure for the folks in Santa Cruz, But I repeat it anyway, because who knows? Might be a new person listening to this broadcast, and it's something the news media almost always omits when it talks about, oh, we're so happy they got rid of that unsightly Ross Camp, that great public nuisance, that great health hazard, that needle mania place, that slant on the campground, which is what you get from mainstream media and from the bigot-compliant, bigot-enabling Santa Cruz City Council, and most importantly, the Santa Cruz City staff, which really runs things in Santa Cruz government-wise. All this little takeoff or riff on city attorneys. I don't have a lot of respect for city attorneys. I think I've only known one that I had any respect for, Santa Monica city attorney from 40 years ago, Myers, who actually resigned rather than enforce anti-homeless laws in the late 80s in Santa Monica. Continuing with the story, Berkeley Deputy City Attorney Lynn Borgalt shared the city's narrative in an opening statement on the first day of trial in a lawsuit claiming the city selectively targeted homeless campers for evictions and destroyed their property because of their speech. Bergal told the 8-member jury that homeless campers chose to pitch tents in troublesome places to pick a fight with the city. I would say perhaps to expose the city's lack of shelter. And if that means you have to be confrontational about it, yeah, around an issue that impacted the entire community and was a matter of the right to give free speech and to express those views. In fact, important for the Berkeley community to know, because if you don't provide shelter or you don't give people a way of at least establishing their own shelter in reasonable areas where they can support each other in self-managed communities, then they'll do it where they have to, where they can, where they must. And that can be uncomfortable for the people whose homes are nearby. It can be uncomfortable for the homeless themselves. It doesn't necessarily allow for sanitation facilities, particularly since for-profit businesses and bigoted city agencies, as we've seen in Santa Cruz, shut down their bathrooms, as Loudoun Nelson has done for the last year, or City Hall has done for the last 3 years here in Santa Cruz. Ross Dress for Less did, even for its customers, when one of our Huff members went in to use the bathroom. She was an elderly woman. She had a medical problem. They wouldn't let her do it. She literally shat her pants. And it really humiliated and horrified her, and actually maybe encouraged her to become an activist. In 2015, a group called First They Came for the Homeless, I think they may have been founded before then, but I'm not sure, organized multiple drug-free encampments in prominent spots around Berkeley to raise awareness about homelessness and affordable housing issues. And, of course, not to mention to have places for people to live who are homeless, since I don't think anybody in those encampments is living there by choice because they have an option to be indoors. In fact, they actually serve as transitional encampments to some indoor living places, though not a lot of people get indoors from encampments, not because the encampments aren't successful, but because the housing isn't available. Berkeley police cleared the group's encampments, the story continues, 12 times in 3 months. Actually, I think it was more like 17 times. Maybe that was in a larger number of months. Between October 2016 and January 2017, while leaving other camps in place. A Berkeley police operations plan also established a goal of, quote, deterring the group from, quote, establishing an illegal encampment on city property. Of course, any encampment on any city property is illegal in Berkeley, as it is in Santa Cruz. Being poor and visible and going to sleep at night is illegal. Now you might say to me, well, wait a minute, isn't there a court decision over Idaho Way, Boise v. Martin, that says that ain't the case, that you can't go after people who are homeless for violating the sleeping ban and camping ordinances if you ain't got place for them to live? And the answer is that's what the court said, but the Berkeley and Santa Cruz police do it anyway using other ordinances. And, of course, this lawsuit dates back to 2017, before the actual formal implementation of the September 2018 Boise v. Martin decision. Despite that evidence, Borgalt, the city attorney, told jurors the group tried to provoke the city by camping in the most inappropriate locations, including on sidewalks, street medians, across from a public high school, and on the steps of City Hall. Of course, you camp on the steps of City Hall because you are trying to make the point that they need to take some action and some issues. We've done that repeatedly, so if homeless in other cities, it's not at all inappropriate. In fact, it's probably the most appropriate place, the city, the center of government. Sidewalks are one of the places it's legal to be when they've closed off all other areas at night. Street medians are also places where there's some kind of grassy area in Berkeley anyway. And across from a public high school, well, the public high school in Berkeley occupies a number of blocks, and I don't know what their rationale for camping there was, but I don't see that that necessarily corrupts a public high school. In fact, it may educate some of the high school students as to what's going on. They picked these locations, the city master of bigotry, I'm sorry, city attorney says, so that they could turn around and accuse the city of targeting them to create a narrative that the city of Berkeley treats homeless people like trash. See, the city is just the victim in the mind of, or at least in the words, of city attorney Burgalt. The Berkeley city lawyer said members of the group scribbled suicide messages on sidewalks near a public high school. One message, she said, dared a parent, give me $5,000 and I'll stop writing about suicide on the sidewalks. According to Burgalt, the homeless campers also smeared feces on the entry doors to City Hall more than once. Was the city really expected to do nothing about that kind of behavior, she asked. Now, of course, whenever anybody raises these issues about a campsite, my immediate response is, well, I know I might actually find some way of justifying this kind of behavior under certain circumstances. If there's no bathrooms, you may want to bring bags of shit to the city council to let them, encourage them to open up the bathrooms that need to be there, so homeless people don't have to take a crap in the bushes, and house people don't have to deal with piles of shit in their neighborhoods. Well, you might also, I mean, once you've tried, you know, the reasonable approach, hey, we need a bathroom, and you get no response, or you get, we're appointing a commission to study it for some years, or we'll get back to you sometime this summer, as the city council here in Santa Cruz has said, after council member Glover tried to get some action in January. At first he couldn't get it on the agenda, then when he finally forced it on the agenda, it got postponed for 3 months. And actually, it's going to be postponed further, I believe. The issue is, if somebody is committing a crime, and you really feel it's significant, like you want to arrest someone for writing something on the sidewalk that talks about, I don't know, the high suicide rate among homeless people, and puts it in the form of a dare, and you think that they should, instead of dealing with the issue of suicide, you should go after the person for writing the message, all right, well, find a law that criminalizes that, but don't attempt to arrest everyone in the encampment or drive people away at night and make them all unsafe. I mean, this is pretty elementary kind of stuff, this kind of analysis. It doesn't take a lot of brains or deep logic to get to this conclusion, I think. But these are the kind of arguments used by anti-homeless folks or by cities trying to defend, city attorneys trying to defend anti-homeless behavior. Continuing the story, but three named plaintiffs, Clark Sullivan, Adam Bredenberg, and Benjamin Royer, tell a different story. City civil rights attorney Dan Siegel of Siegel, Yee, Brunner, and Mehta in Oakland said the city declined to give homeless campers sanitary facilities or hand washing stations or showers or garbage pickup, as they now do in Santa Cruz. You may remember they did provide him at the Ross Camp, but when the Ross Camp was dispersed with only a fraction of that number going in any kind of shelter, either at River Street, 7th Avenue, or Laurel, all the rest of the campers are expected to just, I don't know, build their own bathrooms, hold their water all night, avoid taking a shit except when they can, you know, beg their way into public facilities at restaurants or in get into public facilities during the day. It's weird. It's not, of course. It's standard because it's part of this strange, twisted, cruel mentality that if you only are harsh enough to people, they will all disappear. And that's what you really want to happen. We don't have sanitary facilities, washing stations, showers, or garbage pickup for homeless people in Santa Cruz for the overwhelming majority of those folks. And it's not just Berkeley, which this story is really about. It's about Santa Cruz and other cities, but most particularly it's about us. Or that's what I would be encouraging you to think about as you hear this. Bergalt, the city attorney, questioned the motives for organizing protest camps, saying it enabled the group to exploit the term protest as a get-out-of-jail-free card for illegal camping. Where does the shelter end and the expression begin? Bergalt asked. And of course, none of them are talking about the Martin versus Boise decision because, again, during the time when these covering this lawsuit, which is, again, a bunch of homeless people, as we are doing here in Santa Cruz, suing the city for damages, for the damages they suffered because the city destroyed their encampments, quite similar to the Ross camp. Only the difference here is they are arguing it's a free speech issue, whereas the Ross Camp defendants in the Desiree Quintero case, as it's called here, are arguing that they were putting homeless people at risk. It's probably also true in Berkeley, but they're not making that argument in the case of these three defendants, or I should say plaintiffs, who are Clark Sullivan, Adam Bredenberg, and Benjamin Royer. Berkeley also denies it seized and dumped homeless people's possessions during encampment sweeps. The city promised to keep valuable unattended property in storage for up to 90 days. Of course, the Santa Cruz police made similar promises about Ross Camp. But if you went out there the day or two or three or four after the camp was fenced off and people were banned from coming back to get their property, except during a narrow window between 9 and 12 on the Monday following the Friday closing, you would see massive amounts of property being bulldozed and crushed, including what seemed to be usable items. Now, I couldn't get in there. I didn't get in there. I didn't attempt to jump the fence and analyze it, perhaps as a good reporter should. But it looked to me like a lot of stuff that people couldn't carry away. They didn't have the wherewithal to do it or the place to take it to. Their property was destroyed by the Santa Cruz City. And that, of course, is one of the claims being made here in this lawsuit in Berkeley by these three plaintiffs. But the plaintiffs say they lost essential equipment like tents, sleeping bags, cell phones, and cooking equipment despite trying to retrieve their property from the city. It's a failure by the city to safely take custody of, store, and return to homeless people property that was taken during these raids, Siegel, their attorney, said. Taking the stand as the first witness Monday, former police lieutenant Andrew Rativer said he was involved with hundreds of homeless encampment sweeps during his 30-year career with the Berkeley Police Department from 1988 to 2018. Failing to directly answer the same question posed in different ways, Rativer begrudgingly acknowledged homeless people are not allowed to camp anywhere in the city. Siegel asked the former police lieutenant if he ever told homeless campers where they could go after he forced them to pack up their stuff and leave a location. No, we did not, Rativer said, adding the police did ask if people needed help and sometimes referred them to a shelter. Of course, shelters were, I don't know if there's any evidence presented, but in Santa Cruz it's generally the case the shelters are either full, or if they're not full, they can't accommodate the number of people that are being evicted, or if they can't accommodate some of them, other circumstances make the shelters unusable for them because of distance, because of jobs, because of drug use, where they're not allowed to, and they are addicted to drugs, and so their choices are limited there. The trial is expected to continue until May 30th. That's the story. Jury must decide if Berkeley retaliated against homeless for speech, and it's in a newspaper or on an online publication called Courthouse News Service. And then there's a second story. Witnesses recount aggressive raids on Berkeley homeless camps. The next day, on the 21st, again by Nicholas Yoving, again from the Courthouse News Service, on the second day of a trial over claims that Berkeley, California targeted homeless campers for their speech, witnesses Tuesday described how police repeatedly raided their camps and seized their property as they grew more vocal in opposing city policies. I felt we were being harassed because we were doing political work, said Clark Sullivan, a homeless Berkeley resident and lead plaintiff in the suit against the city. We were being singled out to get us to stop, he added. Sullivan, a 58-year-old man with health problems and limited mobility, said he was live-streaming a police raid when city workers snatched his purple suitcase and threw it in the back of a truck. When he retrieved the luggage from a city storage unit months later, he said the clothing inside was ruined and covered in mildew. Sullivan is one of four former and current homeless campers who testified Tuesday about the city's aggressive crackdown on homeless activists' encampments between October 2016 and January 2017. The city says the camps were targeted for health and safety reasons, which of course was the pretext used in Santa Cruz, not to retaliate against the group's political activism. Also testifying Tuesday was Mike Zint, co-founder of First They Came for the Homeless, I mentioned him earlier, a group that organized multiple drug-free encampments in prominent spots around Berkeley to raise awareness about homelessness and affordable housing issues. Zint, who is not a plaintiff in the case, told jurors he lost everything he owned in a November 2016 raid outside of Berkeley City Hall. Zint said he was arrested because police decided he wasn't moving fast enough after they woke him up at 4:30 a.m. and ordered him to start packing. "The police were trying to force me to move before my medication had an opportunity to take effect," Zint said. U.S. District Judge William Alsup told the jury to disregard testimony about Zint's lost possessions because he is not one of the three plaintiffs with claims of lost or damaged property against the city. The issue might arise in the minds of a juror, and I wonder why William Alsup would find this illegitimate, the judge, that if they can disregard his property, then they might also be disregarding the property of the plaintiffs. It might be a practice. It might be a habit. It might be a preference, even. Who knows? Plaintiffs Benjamin Royer and Adam Bredenberg also described losing property in camp sweeps or finding other people's tents discarded in dumpsters after police raids. On cross-examination, Berkeley Deputy City Attorney Lynn Burgalt challenged the notion that police acted as villains when clearing encampments. She noted that police officers offered to help campers move their stuff and sometimes brought them coffee and donuts. Burgalt asked the four witnesses if they ever heard city officials say why they were clearing their camps. The reasons given were in written notices stating that the camps were unsanitary or in violation of laws that prohibit lodging on public property, according to the witnesses. A brief aside here, one of the things that activists are now trying to do, given the Boise versus Martin decision that says you can't use Santa Cruz's sleeping ban or camping ordinances to go after people, but you can, police are still moving a hell of a lot of people around town, threatening them and their property, doing ID checks, warrant checks, and searches on them, and making their lives uncomfortable and making them feel like criminals for simply being homeless on the streets. And the pretext for this are laws that are supposedly being violated, whether it's blocking the sidewalk, being in a park after dark, being in a property that's closed off. And we're not talking about private property here. We're talking about public property, much of which is now closed to the public during a lot of the times when previously it had been open, like City Hall, which used to be open 24 hours a day, not the building, but the grounds around it, or the police station, not the building, but the grounds around it, and similarly with the library, or just being on public property, and the claim then becomes you are illegally lodging if you are sitting there at night, maybe covered up with a blanket, or maybe with a tent against the rain, or under an awning. And there again, you may be accused of being on private property in the rain because the owner of the store, even though the store is closed, nobody's there, and you would wonder who would give a shit. They are still, the police are still feel they have the right to or the responsibility to go over there and drive people out into the rain with no legal place to go because they're violating the laws. In other words, the issue becomes for us, some of us homeless activists, how do we make sure that these new laws, stay-away ordinances in the parks, being in a park after dark, being in a closed area, blocking the sidewalk, public nuisance, all these things that don't have anything to do with substantial crimes, but are really sort of another verbalization of the sleeping ban, but verbalized in such a way that they don't, in a clear, explicit way, violate the court's rulings around the Boise versus Martin rights that were seemed to have been sort of established by that decision, at least for the moment. Continuing with this story. Attorney also questioned in Berkeley whether the homeless plaintiffs made good faith efforts to retrieve their belongings from the city following camp evictions. "Did you ever think, gee, that property is really important to me, I better go figure out how to get it back," Burgalt said. Royer, a 33-year-old homeless man with severe back pain and limited mobility, said he relied on other members of the group to help him retrieve the sleeping bag, tarp, and tools he used for a wheelchair, which were lost in a raid. I don't remember if I was told or why they could not find my property, Royer said. I believe I asked on numerous occasions. Now, in Santa Cruz, the only way you can get your property back from the police, assuming that they're not charging you with a crime for being on the sidewalk or being homeless outside in a park after dark, is if the DA or the city attorney has dropped any charges against you or is not filing charges against you. And, of course, there are many, many charges being filed. The statements by Chief Mills, notwithstanding his claims that we've stopped enforcing the sleeping ban, tickets are way down. He doesn't mention the tickets are way up for being in a park after dark, violation of the being in a closed area rules, or the de facto trespassing, no trespassing rules. If your property has been taken by the police, and they say, oh, okay, we're not going to charge you, come and get your property, you have to show up during a very narrow interval, Tuesdays or Thursdays, between 12:30 and 2:30, are the only times that our police department allows people to pick up their property. That, at least, is the last I heard of it within the last month or two. And I don't think that's changed. I think I would have heard of it if that whole had changed. And I certainly hope, Chief Mills, if you're listening to this broadcast, that you're changing it tomorrow, if not yesterday. Particularly important for people whose survival cure you're holding. More important with the destruction of the Ross camp, I theorize, and I'm not speaking because people have come to me talking to me about this, but this is just my thought, my speculation. Because people who are supportive, or were supportive of the Ross camp, different churches, the Democratic Socialists, Food Not Bombs, Huff, other groups, the California Homeless Union, can't get to these people anymore with the ease they used to because they're scattered all over the city and all over the county now. And that being the case, it's much more difficult to provide them with tents and survival gear and clothing if that's what people want to do, because they're no longer, at least one large group of them, is no longer in one place. Now, again, as I always have said, 300 people at the Ross camp is still only a fraction of 1,000 to 2,000 people in the city, homeless people in the city. So that has to be considered as well. Burgalt, the Berkeley city attorney, also asked about claims that the group smeared feces on the entrance of City Hall and scribbled suicide messages on a sidewalk near Berkeley High School. Zint said the city has no evidence that his group spattered poop on the entry doors of City Hall. However, Sullivan admitted the group poured in red paint on the steps of the building. Zint said the suicidal chalk writings were written by a group member suffering from mental health problems. The disturbing messages were not endorsed by the group, he added. When asked why that person was not ejected from camp, Zint said he would never abandon a person with mental health problems who needed help. I'm not going to kick a suicidal man out of his support network, Zint said. According to Zint, the group organized protest camps with the goal of persuading the city to establish a sanctioned camp on a piece of public property with toilets, trash pickup, and other city services. All four witnesses testified Tuesday that they believe police targeted them for protesting in prominent places, speaking out at city council meetings, and writing opinions pieces critical of city government. All too often, people who are homeless are dehumanized because their whole existence is seen as against the law, Sullivan told jurors. We wanted to show that we have rights and that we are the same as anybody else. Though his calendar indicates the trial may go through May 30th, Alsup, the judge, said Tuesday that he expects both sides to finish presenting evidence by Friday. Berkeley City Manager D. Williams Ridley, who started testifying at the end of the day Tuesday, is expected to continue her testimony Wednesday. Don't have any stories from yesterday, Wednesday's court actions, or court actions today on Thursday, the 23rd. But hopefully I will on Sunday if the news media gives them to me. I'll also perhaps have an interview with Mike Zint if I can get through to him. Let's take a musical break.
so the guy
can cry no more
and gave us new ones.
I can't cry no more.
Then they stole our beauty.
I can't cry no more.
The comfort in our skin.
I can't cry no more.
And then they gave us duty.
I can't cry no more.
And then they gave us sin.
I can't cry no more.
And then came generations. Acts of malice and hatred without cease.
I can cry no more.
Foul and dirty river
no
runs through this sacred land.
I can cry no more.
With every act of terror,
I can cry no more.
They tell us where we stand.
I can cry no more.
500 years of honor.
Rhiannon Giddens, Cry No More. Video has essentially takes place in a church, if you look at the video online, and it shows folks coming out of the different seats, joining the choir, and then being led by a woman with a drum who's beating it, We Don't Cry No More. And at the end of that whole video, there's a logo that says, Know Your History, Know Your Mind, Speak Up, Be Loud. So about a week ago, a number of us went out to the River Street campground to make sure that the visitor's policy promised by Captain Laubach was in force. And indeed it was. If you're on a list, you could get in, or at least we could. We were told by Laubach on audio tape and on video that we could come at any time of the day or night. But he later informed Eric, the director, that he had never said that, which he apparently had forgotten or was simply wrong in representing that he hadn't said that, because I played it on the air and he did. But in any case, the policy seems to be between 10 and 3:30 or something. And the director, Eric, said that it's mostly a matter of staff, that he wants, that's really the issue. It's not that he wants to keep people out, but he wants to kind of make sure it can, people can be monitored. I'm not going to justify that. But in any case, we went in there, and one woman outside wanted to talk to me. She was on the other side of the barbed wire. I don't know, she tried to get in and they wouldn't let her, or she didn't try to get in or whatever. But I went outside and we chatted, and we had this conversation.
Oh, it's around 12:20. We're talking with L.A. And L.A., you say that you had a chance to come into the River Street camp. You decided against it. Why was that?
I'm going to give it to somebody who needs it more.
Do you have a place you're sleeping?
Yes, I've been there for 4 years, and I've been keeping it up and doing what I'm supposed to do, keeping it clean, respecting the earth. So I'm comfortable. My issue today is the house right across the street from us.
Say that again.
The house, the blue and white house right there, it's been boarded up for 12 years, 1217 River.
Yeah.
I want to know why it's boarded up and how come we can't open it as a resource and refuge. That's what I want to do with it.
Who owns it?
The city. The city can't tear it down because it's historical. You say they boarded it up. And I did research on it, and it used to be a resource center, but they closed it down for whatever reason. And now the house has just been sitting vacant. I talked to City Councilman Drew Glover the other day about this issue. He said it sounded like a good idea, and that he was going to check into it, but I haven't heard back from him. I want to open it up as a work resource to give these kids and people a place positive to go and look forward to. I want them to have access to going back to school. I want them to have access to whatever resources they need. Let no man go without. That's what our motto is going to, or any woman, exactly. Let them have what they need to get back on their feet and get to go on and take their place in society that they're supposed to. These kids have nothing but a dark hole that they're living in. And if you have nobody to care enough to lift you up to the sun, lift your face up to the sun, and show you which way to go out, how are they supposed to escape? We met a boy who killed himself yesterday on the tracks.
Who was that?
I'm not sure who they were. I didn't know his name, but I know that it's across from where I live, and that these kids moved out there after the encampment closed because I guess they didn't think that they had anywhere else to turn. And that's a crying shame, you know. I lost a friend of mine, he's 40 years old, Mr. Davis Briggs, because he didn't have a warm place to sleep at night to heal.
How long ago was that?
That was in February. He died 2 days after his birthday. And I just, it just kills me. It's breaking my heart to see, I can't stand to see my friends die on the sidewalk anymore because they don't have a blanket or they don't have a warm place to sleep. This is a big, huge house that's been boarded up. The city owns. It wouldn't cost them anything. Just a fraction to go and pay the utilities on it.
This woman here standing there in front of the house?
I don't have no idea. Never seen anybody around it for all these years, 10 years. There's another little house in the back. It's got four. It's a quadruplet apartments. It's got four apartments in it. We can make this into a program that trains people to go and get back into the workforce. We can have certified electricians that teach them how to be an electrician, teach them that skill, how to be a plumber, how to do construction. Whatever they want to learn, then it would be at their access to. So,
were you previously at Ross Camp, by the way?
No, but I was advocating the same thing over there, losing my voice. I even tried to go to City Hall, but I chickened out.
Okay, they don't listen much anyway, but yeah, Glover tries to, and, you know, I would say if you can, get back to him and try to talk to him. I mention your name. Do you want to say your name for the broadcast?
I'm Miss L.A. Lost my voice. I'm sorry.
It's okay. And do you have a phone number or email?
I do. It's Linda.
I'll put it on
4 years.
So it's around 12.
So far, I haven't really followed up on this issue with Miss L.A. But actually, I'm about to call Drew Glover to get the update on the situation with the upcoming city council meeting, which, again, I don't think we have the agenda for. Rather than have Drew repeat himself, because he gave us kind of an update at the Huff and Conscience in Action meetings on, well, yesterday, I'm going to play that portion of the meeting where he talked to us by phone. And he was advised this was being recorded, so we were clearing it with him before we did. And this is what he had to say.
0838.
Thank you, Steve. Should we give Drew a call and see what he has to say? So Drew Glover is a council member who about to give a call to see if he wants to advise us on what may or may not be what he wants to come up on the council agenda, which is next Tuesday, is that right? Wow, so soon?
It is next Tuesday.
It is next Tuesday. Okay, so we're dialing Drew here. And one thing he does on the agenda, have on the agenda maybe, is criminalization of the homeless, examining ordinances to see which of them particularly.
Hello, this is Drew.
Hey, Drew, it's Robert calling from the Huff Conscience in Action meeting.
We are recording this meeting. I just got a couple questions for you if you got time. Yes. First of all, anything coming up on the agenda you want us to be aware of? I know you haven't got it yet, but as far as you can anticipate.
I have no idea what's coming on the agenda.
Okay, but we assume that the since it was indeed voted, was it not, that there be the criminalization issue, at least in part, coming back, correct?
You're correct that there was a vote on that, but then at the end of the evening, Vice Mayor Cummings made a motion to reconsider that vote and then made a motion, which passed, to reconsider it. And then he made the motion to, instead of agendizing the issues, to only have the reports delivered to city council members no later than June 11th.
Oh, boy.
So it won't be agendized for the next two meetings at least, and then that means that the only opportunity we'll have to have any substantive action and discussion on it is the last meeting in June before the one-month break through July. So at the soonest, we'll hear it the last week or last meeting of June. At the latest, we won't hear it until maybe August.
Has your investigation ended so we can actually hear what's going on with that now?
No.
By investigation, what I meant was Drew has repeatedly said that he can't be as aggressive with challenging the mayor's refusal to put items on the agenda, pressing to have the whole process changed, because he is afraid he has to defend himself against some unknown to us, anonymous, or maybe they're not anonymous, investigation that is going on around him. And I've requested repeatedly what the fuck he's talking about, but he won't say anything because it was in closed session of city council, to which I reply, no, you're a city council member. If you're being investigated, it's not a closed matter, particularly if you are choosing to talk about it yourself for the benefit of your constituents, to let them know why you cannot or are being forced to pull in your horns on various issues ranging from rent control to behavior of the mayor at city council to behavior of the police against the homeless. The issue that I was asking him about in this phone conversation was a matter which he asked my help for way back in January with his interns to specify which ordinances I thought needed to be examined by the city for their disproportionate negative impact on the homeless, such as the most obvious one, the sleeping ban. Others would be smoking ban in parks, the being in a park after dark, stay away orders, sitting down on the sidewalk. And these ordinances were supposed to be looked into fairly quickly, according to what he requested. But when it came to the vote of the city council, he, perhaps fearing a negative vote from Justin Cummings, perhaps appropriately fearing a negative vote, he had them delayed for 3 months until this May, it was actually until the May 14th meeting, the meeting which was the last city council meeting that we had. At the 14th meeting, it was agreed that the matter would come back on the 28th. At least some of the data would be brought back, and then city attorney admitted that he had actually been derelict in not getting the stuff out on the 14th as he was supposed to. But apparently at the end of the evening, in a vote that I missed, and I think I played much of it, much of that council meeting, in one of my prior shows, I have to go back and listen to it again, Justin Cummings changed his vote. And so therefore, it was postponed, as you hear, the whole issue of which ordinances are disproportionately used against homeless people. And if so, how and why and how frequently, and has there been a change in the last year and so forth, gets postponed at least until the last meeting in June and maybe until August after the city council comes back from its, I guess, July vacation. I assume this year maybe it's in July. I haven't heard for sure. So that's what they're talking about with respect to the investigation and the ordinance discussion. for non-discussion, silence.
We have a question from another person. Go ahead, Julie.
Hi, Drew. This is Julie. I met you at the meeting last Monday. I believe he did want people from either House for Food Not Books to get together to have a meeting with the Center for Nonviolence to move forward on what our agenda is and how to get there. He had some... Drew, can you clarify what it was your group was looking for?
We said that we are interested in helping to support the nonviolent action campaigns of organizations locally focusing on positive projects. So if the group is planning on developing or enacting a nonviolent action campaign and or wants to plan a nonviolent direct action, then the center, the resource center, is happy to share in that brainstorming and implementation.
Yeah, like strategize and mobilize. Okay.
Will you be having an intern meeting on Friday to chat about the agenda once it comes out tomorrow?
Yes. Well, actually, let me see if it got to my calendar, because I think I got scheduled for a ride-along at that time with one of the sergeants. So we could do it on nonviolence training all weekend. So we could do it on Monday afternoon or Monday evening.
Memorial Day? Okay.
Well, are people here, anybody interested in going to a meeting with Drew? Well, you intending to do that anyway for your own benefit, or?
I hadn't talked about it with my team, and it looks like all of my interns actually have that day off, so it may not happen this week. You know, if you have things that you go through the agenda and not identify, you can send me an email with the item numbers in your notes, and then I can take that into consideration if we don't have an official meeting. It's probably easier that way.
Hmm.
I'll go to a meeting if you need to.
Julie volunteers to go to a meeting. Are you, should we try to schedule something now as a tentative time? Or it sounds like you'd
just give me a call on Sunday.
All right. How do people feel? Is anybody interested in going to an intern meeting anyway on Monday, period?
And it's not an intern meeting. It is a...
meeting with you.
It's an agenda review, essentially, where we review the agenda.
Agenda review. So we have one guy from River Street.
Anything else I can help you with before I leave, because I have to do other things.
Hey, Drew. Real quick, this is Greg Benson. I just moved into... hi there. Just moved in. Susie O'Hara somehow got me into the River Street campground yesterday.
But I can't hear you.
Can you hear me now? Drew? Did you push the mute button?
It's doing.
Well, I can hear you now.
Oh, you can hear me now? Okay, yeah, it's Greg Benson. Susie O'Hara got me into the River Street campground yesterday somehow. I just showed up at City Hall. But I just wanted to give you an update on that. But you had been looking for some people to take part in that, some sort of film project. And it was hectic. I know you were going to start that on the 13th. Is that still going on? Did you still?
Yeah, it was an ongoing project.
Okay, I'll talk to you some other time about that.
Okay, great.
Okay.
Are you anything you want to ask us?
Not at the moment, but if I think of anything, I'll make sure to give you a call or send an email.
And you haven't gotten access to any of these records that were supposed to be hurriedly and belatedly done by Condotti around infractions?
June
11th. Uh-huh. Does that include analysis, or does that just the data?
It includes analysis of the sleeping, urination, and loitering, I believe, and then it has the data for the dogs smoking, all that other kind of stuff.
Okay.
I do have one.
Steve's got a question.
Update. It's not a question, Drew. It's an update. I talked to Patty Brady, who operates the Loads of Love trailer, and he connected me with Ron Powers, who operates their nonprofit. They're going to have the Loads of Love trailer out at 1220 River Street Camp next Wednesday to offer a laundry for the folks out there. So just so you know, they'll be out there next Wednesday night at 6:30.
Oh, great. I love that I get more real-time updates from you than I do from my staff.
All right, brother. Thanks for the work.
Yes, thank you very much. Have a great day.
I'll give you a call about that Monday meeting. Thank you.
Okay, sounds good.
Hey, thank you, Drew. Anything else? Anybody?
No, have a great day.
All right. Thank you, Matt.
So I'm on the line with Councilmember Drew Glover, also a community activist, who is going to give us a kind of an update further on what you just heard, which is the significance of the postponement of the criminalization data and analysis from what was supposed to be May 14th all the way to end of June and maybe until August. And also maybe, Drew, an update on anything that you've proposed around the very important transitional encampments, although transition to what, I got no idea, and other stuff that you've been trying to get action on, bathrooms and so forth. Kind of give us an update, but start with the stuff about what does it mean that the city attorney has delayed this stuff?
Well, wasn't that the city attorney delayed it, that the vice mayor delayed it. Unfortunately, there was a motion made at the end of the evening that was made by the vice mayor and supported by the remaining council members that were still present after the whole public comment debacle, which resulted in a delayed meeting and, in my opinion, a poor decision on the side of the council. But because the vice mayor introduced that motion and it was supported by the remaining council members that were present, it made it so that he made a secondary motion after the to reconsider. After that motion was made, he then made the motion to make it so staff would bring back information to us by no later than June 11th. So it's great to have the information coming back and wonderful that we'll be able to look at it. The problem with that and the concern I have with that decision is that it makes it so that at the earliest that we'll be able to talk about the criminalization of the poor or the criminalization of poverty in Santa Cruz will be the second meeting in June. The trick there is that there's already been conversations from both the mayor and the vice mayor talking about all the other things that have been underrepresented on the agenda because of the focus on homelessness, and so therefore the agenda can be anticipated to be full of a whole bunch of other things that don't have to do with homelessness. If that is the case, through the rest of June, then the city council goes on break starting on July 3rd, I believe, and then we're on break through the entire month of July. So at the earliest we'll hear anything about this item coming back on the agenda will be the last meeting in June, but if that doesn't happen, then we're not going to hear about it until the first meeting in August, which has then pushed back the ability for the council to critically analyze the situation and the criminalization of poor people in Santa Cruz for at least 2 months if it doesn't get on the final meeting in June. So there's a lot of concern around that for me personally. There's a saying by Dr. King, justice delayed is justice denied.
Oh, yeah.
And it's very much that thought process for me is that every day that goes by where people who are some of the most vulnerable in our community are being subjected to citations on things that may not be regarding to sleeping, quote unquote, because of the city's concern about the Martin versus Boise decision, but taking the form of things like trespassing or other kinds of penalization, which hurts low-income people and potentially their credit.
Particularly since they've been driven out of, many of them, out of the largest encampment that they had, the Ross Camp, without adequate shelter.
That's one facet of a much larger picture of the hardships they've had to deal with being poor in Santa Cruz and experiencing homelessness, but that is definitely one of the reasons.
Why do you think Justin Cummings changed his vote? I was locked out of the council meeting along with other people, and that wasn't very comfortable for me to be able to hang around outside, so I left, by the way, which I think is a pretty clear Brown Act violation, and I hope that that everything that got done at that meeting, and it was only, I guess, wastewater management, maybe the vote by Justin Cummings, the reconsideration vote, needs to be thrown out and redone because we weren't allowed in. And you can evict people who are disruptive, and maybe they could claim I was disruptive because I did say shame at one point, for sure, when the mayor refused to allow people to speak at the who aren't still in line. But there were plenty of people in the audience who did not, and they were also excluded. So, I mean, they were excluded from coming back into the chambers, and I think that's a violation of the Brown Act. But why? Why do you think Justin changed his vote? Did you chat with him about it? Did he give any public reasons?
You'd have to ask him. I've had a couple conversations with him about it, but I don't want to speak for him.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there is a... I mean, the statements have been made both by the mayor and the vice mayor about the concern about the overloaded staff and other things that they want to focus on. So I think that that was his primary, from my understanding, his primary reason for reconsidering it was to make sure that there would be room on the agenda for other items that don't have to do with homelessness because of the feeling that it has monopolized the agenda.
Well, it is true that the budget hearing...
It's an unfortunate position to take, that as it is something that is
for sure
crisis level in our community right now and is impacting thousands of people. But to each their own.
Well, it's true that the budget hearings are coming up in, I guess, in June, and those take up, what, full days. But I think it's also true that, was it not, if I remember the May 14th meeting, that the city attorney acknowledged that most of the work had already been done, at least on the more, you know, important issues that Sandy Brown was concerned about. Right, that you were all concerned about, but specifically, you know, that the work had been done, that it didn't need to take up an additional, particularly huge amount of staff time.
Right, and again, you ought to talk to Vice Mayor Cummins about that logic.
And you say I ought to talk to him, or you've talked to him, and he's given you a meaningful and succinct reply.
You'll have to speak with him because I don't want to speak for him or represent his position.
In other words, he spoke to you in confidence, or...
speculate or miscommunicate what he may reach out to him and talk to him. he's an elected official as well.
Yeah, I know. He's a hard man to talk to. He has never responded to any request I made unless I make it in public at a council meeting and one of the breaks. So it's not going to happen. If you don't give me information, I'm not likely to get it directly. I feel like I send him emails, he doesn't respond. So that's why I ask you if you have any idea about that. And I understand.
Like I said, I believe it probably, my assumption is it has to do with the wanting to prioritize other things on the agenda.
What do you think is coming up on the agenda that is going to be important in any way that you've noticed? I know you haven't got the agenda.
I have no idea because I'm not allowed to be in agenda review. There's been no strategic plan for the council, so we have no idea what our direction is with regards to the body as a unit. And I have no idea.
Are you, Brown and Crone, meeting as a group at all to plan any strategies, or is that not happening?
Sometimes we meet as a group. Other times we meet individually.
As a regular thing.
Also community groups that we meet with. So.
I mean, do you meet as a caucus, I guess is what I'm asking? I got you. Anything that's non-council related that you think is perhaps as important, if not more important, than the city council's peregrinations that we should know about that's coming up that you want to let us be aware of?
The hunger strike in the jail, the death at the Roundtree facility.
Tell me about that.
I don't have time, but you can do your own research. Things to look up. I got to run. I told you I have 5 minutes.
You did.
But I hope that you... have a wonderful afternoon, and thank you for staying on top of local politics.
I'm trying to.
All right, I'll see you later.
Bye-bye. And that was Drew Clever giving us the quickest sign-off he's ever given me, but I did say 5 minutes.
Said you're gonna shoot me down, put my body in the river. Shoot me down, put my body in the river while the whole world sings. Sing it like a song. The whole world sings like there's nothing going wrong. He shot her down, he put her body in the river. He covered her up, but I went to get her and I said, my girl, what happened to you now? I said, my girl, we gotta stop it somehow. Thank you. sick and sad. Tell me, what's a man with a rifle in his hand gonna do for a world that's all gone mad? He's gonna shoot me down, put my body in the river, cover me up with the leaves of September like an old sad song. You heard it all before, well, deal is gone, but I'm settling the score.
Hooray for the Riff Raff by The Body Electric, which gets a lot of positive comments on YouTube. It is, according to some of the comments, a meditation on the acceptance of violence and discrimination against people of color, women, and the LGBTQ community. I always prefer more explicit lyrics, but, well... hope you liked it.
Okay, well, it's around 3:15, and I'm getting a phone call from Conscience in Action activist Phil Posner, who has been active in working to assure visitors' rights to the number of areas, but particularly to the River Street campground at 1220 River. And, Phil, what's a good word?
Well, so Eric did call me. He said he was going to try to call you too, but I told him that I would tell you that, yeah, the guy in question, I don't want to say his name publicly. I think you even know him. Will be glad to see me, and I'm going to go visit him tomorrow.
Now, the issue we had, Phil, was can an ordinary person, once they've contacted someone there, get on a list that indicates that they can walk by and say, I want to see such and such, and get into the camp without, you know, an elaborate process of delay. Did we get any sense of that yet?
Yes and no. Their position is that they have to be attentive to the needs of their clients. So in this case, for example, Eric, the director, needed to contact the client, the guy that I...
Let me interrupt you, Phil, because my question really is this. If the client has put on a list, I want this person to be able to visit me any time of the day or night, and I'm sorry, I'm sounding a little impatient because I've been wrestling with this for quite a while. You seem to be very, very patient with these people in ways that I'm not, and therefore I get impatient with you, probably improperly, because we have different styles, you know. But I want to know whether if someone's on the list, we aren't going to get this long prolegomena about, oh, well, you know, we have our best needs of our clients and our confidentiality. If you're on the list, you get in any time you show up. If the person who is there has said, I want to see this person.
I think the answer is yes, but I didn't. I think the answer is yes.
Okay, so we got to find out if...
You didn't ask me to ask him that specific question.
Well, really, that has been the specific question all along,
well,
really.
The question is, was I able to go visit someone? And clearly, I'm able to visit someone.
Well, no, the issue is not whether you, Phil Posner, a dignified individual in the community, can get in to see that person.
Anybody who wants to visit someone and that person says, sure, I'd like to see Jim, can visit Tom.
Well, that's the question, Phil. And that's the question that you said you didn't ask him and that we don't have the answer to. See, that's the problem. We need that.
You want me to call him again and ask him that?
Yeah, that would be good because I think, and what's needed is that, you know.
Why don't you call him?
Well, right now because I'm doing a radio show, but I guess I can. Unfortunately, Eric does not like to be on the air. He's a kind of a private person.
Oh, okay.
You know,
it's on. Listen, you know, I value your passion about these issues, and I will try to call him and ask him that specific question. In other words, once a person is on a list,
mm-hmm.
we're not talking about a rabbi, just any citizen
mm-hmm.
Is on a list, can he visit that person by showing up?
Right, and will the staff facilitate that, or will they say, wait to hear from Captain Harold, we've got to clear it with Eric,
okay.
come back tomorrow, you know, that's the question.
I know the answer to that question, but I will call him and hope that I can reach him again and call you back.
I appreciate that.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks.
And in fact, and I hope I didn't play this on Sunday, perhaps I did, I think Phil did get in touch with him. He also called us back. And I recorded that. It was actually at the Conscience in Action meeting where you heard the brief tape from Drew Glover as well. I'm going to find out if we can actually play that on the air. I don't want Eric, the director of this group, is a rather private person, although he's in a public position, you know, demonstrably. But I'm trying to also, I'm torn here. Let me see if I can actually do this. I tried to reach Eric by phone but couldn't get him just now. But we did reach him yesterday. He did confirm that if members of the community want to deliver food, they could do so without prior approval to the camp, which is good because that was one of the concerns about the breakup of the Ross camp. But, of course, the problem with the River Street camp is, first of all, is a much smaller number of people. There are regular, at least, breakfast and dinner meals provided. And there's also no access by the outer community unless you're on a list from someone who's in the campground. And so there can't be the kind of open sharing of food that there was at the Ross camp. So people who want to provide food for even that limited but larger segment of the community that was the Ross camp when people were providing food there can't do it at the River Street camp in the same way. So we talked about at the Conscience in Action meeting possibly doing it outside the River Street campground, down the road from the River Street campground, on the corner here or there, near the River Street campground. We didn't quite come up with any conclusions at that meeting. But I may actually try to do an update on the things we discussed at the Conscience in Action meeting. And there's often a lot of tumult at the Conscience in Action and Huff meetings, so a lot of strong feelings. I try to see that we actually plan to do something. I think there is a plan for a protest at City Council on the 28th. Part of the issue had to do with the barbed wire. We did learn from, I think, Eric Snickars, the director, the guy I was just mentioning, that he had not gotten any word back from the city manager that they're taking down the barbed wire. And this was the same thing that happened last year when Susie O'Hara assured people at the city council meeting that they were going to be addressing the barbed wire issue, but of course they never did. Barbed wire stayed up. It's stayed up since then. And I think it's unlikely it's going to be taken down. And in a sense, you know, it's more an aesthetic thing than anything else. But it does, they put little kind of peace flags on the barbed wire last year to sort of give it a frilly look. It was kind of an ironic gesture, particularly given the kind of restrictions that were being put on people at that campground and that are still to some extent on the campground now, although it's been liberalized as far as visitors go, at least during the day. But it is true that it was a clear statement by Limbach that there would be 24-hour visiting. I'm going to play that now. May 13th, when we were at the right outside the barbed wire talking with Captain Harold Laubach of the Salvation Army. And you're listening now to Phil Posner presenting his question about visitors.
I think there's one part of this, Harold, that in our phone conversation, I didn't quite understand.
Okay.
And I would appreciate if you would clarify. Salvation Army staff must receive previous client approval for each visit.
Right.
Does that mean, for example, that if I want to see Jim Stein inside, that I have to call you to get approval and How easy is that going to be, considering the fact that it's not necessarily easy to find Jim Stein?
Okay. So this is under the privacy concern of the clients. We simply deal with this. I just want to make sure that Jim is okay with having a visitor. All right. So the deal is, if you call Jim or talk with Jim downtown or whatever, and he puts you on the list of visitors, we're cool. You come and visit Jim Stein, right? But the deal is, what we don't want is unwelcome visitors or just going around tent to tent, you know, yelling at people, waking them up.
Assuming that's all that's going to be.
Oh, not even close. No, we have many legitimate visitors every day.
Why are the visits limited to 30 minutes?
One person at a time, all right? One person at a time.
Okay, so as I understand, your answer is the camp is willing to have visitors, but we must call in order to make sure that the resident approves our visit.
Exactly.
Okay.
And anybody could visit as long as the resident approves their visit.
Now, I got a question. Question is,
Alicia was next.
Alicia, you have a question.
How come these visits are limited to 30 minutes? I find that very kind of stringent, and I might not be able to get everything I need done and spoke about in 30 minutes.
Okay, that's a very good question. And here's the deal. We worked out in those guidelines that it can go longer than 30 minutes if we know that it's going to. And this is why. We have really limited space inside. I mean, even the table space is very limited, right? So if we have, as an example, 16 visitors, that's more table space than we have. So we can go longer than 30 minutes. The guidelines just included that there'd be a request that says, my business is going to take longer than 30 minutes with Jim, so I'm going to need longer. And as long as the staff knows about it ahead of time, we're okay with that. That's okay. So we can be flexible on that as long as there's a reason. Well, what we don't want is just people hanging out all over all day long for no particular reason, right? So that's the privacy part that we're trying to control. Yes, ma'am. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Robert, next, and then
both Alicia's question and Phil's question. First of all, can any member of the staff okay that, or do we have to reach you, the head chief?
You do not have to reach me. Okay. So the member of the staff here, we have a director and a deputy director. Either one of them can.
And their names are?
Eric and Lauren.
And what are contact information for those two?
I can get it to you. I don't know it off the top of my head, but yes, I can get it to you.
And it will be available to members of the public who want to come in and see their friends.
Of course.
So far, he has not gotten that contact information to me regarding Lauren Dixon, but nor actually Eric, but I did get that information about Eric from another source.
In fact, we probably end up posting it.
Okay, and then secondly, are you clarifying that if you're on a list, you can come and go at any time for a period of 30 minutes without that kind of prior approval? If you've gotten the agreement from the person inside that they want to see you?
If they're okay with you visiting at whatever hour? Yeah, I don't see a reason why not.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, we're staffed 24/7. I mean, there's staff here 24/7. There's security here 24/7. So as long as you're on the list of visitation from the client, yeah, we have no limitations on what time of the day you come visit.
Okay.
So there you have it. A pretty clear statement that there are no limitations on the time of day. Yet when 4 days later we showed up, we were told by Director Eric Snickars that there was a limitation. It was from 10 to 3:30. I told Eric, wait a minute, this is not what we were told by the captain. He said, oh, I'll call him up. He called him up, and then he let us know at the meeting yesterday, well, the captain has confirmed it's not going to be 24 hours. So there was a change in the policy, but it was not acknowledged as a change. This, what disturbs me is the friendly attitude and the kind of open, devil may care, let's be buddies approach of Captain Harold Laubach. Either he had a change of attitude, and if he had, you would think that he would present it differently. It's quite a jump from saying that you can come 24 hours a day anytime you want, provided you're on the list if the visitor says it's okay, which should be the case. I mean, you know, if somebody wants you to be able to come and visit them, provided you're quiet about it and you don't cause other troubles, although, indeed, the tents are pretty close together, and I can acknowledge that, there might be actually some reasons for restricting visitors during times because of other people sleeping, but 10 o'clock to 3:30 is not sleeping time. It's only simply, I guess, staff availability or some such thing. Anyway, Another issue I wanted to bring up because it was significant has to do with needle exchange. I've been hoping on this show to get together a program where advocates of even safe injection centers, but at least needle exchange according to the best practices by state authorities, which has to do with one-to-one plus exchange. You don't have to, in other words, have a one-to-one exchange, but you give as much as the people need, not simply one for every one needle based upon the fear that there'll be too many needles or that somehow it's empowering drug addiction by doing that instead of engaging in essentially harm reduction. That there was a statement made by Steve Plaich at the meeting around that, which I think I'm going to play. Needle exchange came up at the yesterday's Conscience in Action meeting, actually in the middle of the Huff meeting, too. We merged those meetings together. And I believe Steve Plaich, who has been involved in the Harm Reduction Coalition, had some thoughts about that. And here's some of that discussion.
Steve, support. Stop. Can somebody get Steve outside before he goes away?
He's on the phone.
Right, because he's the person who's an expert on the needle exchange. I think Conscience in Action should take a stand, or Huff, if Conscience in Action is gone, on the issue of the harassment of needle exchange that is going up big time in the media and all around town. How do people feel about that?
Oh, yes, Greg.
I've talked with Denise, and there's actually, she wanted me to get some people with some pull, some doctors, et cetera, to send emails or just basically, she said they can use all the support possible.
Okay, I do want to say that.
That's Denise Ellerich. He is talking about. And that's one of our homeless activists talking, who had been with the Ross Camp and is now with River Street. Denise has been a longtime supporter of expanded needle exchange and other harm reduction matters with the Harm Reduction Coalition.
According to Eric, he is allowing Steve outside before he goes away.
He's on the phone.
Right, because he's the person who's an expert on the needle exchange, kind of Huff action or Conscience in Action around supporting the right to have needle exchange, its sensibility, not to be restricted to a one-to-one. I mean, I think most of us know the argument.
Yeah, the public comment period is still open until Friday, so what is best...
On what issue? Remind us what that is.
On needle exchange, on the application to certify a secondary needle exchange in Santa Cruz, which would operate in Harvey West, in Watsonville, and I think one other area. And that would be a supplemental exchange, basically. The county exchange would still be operating, but this would be a secondary mobile exchange.
And what would be the implications of it not being certified?
Well, they would have to go it rogue, you know, until they got chased out like the all-volunteer needle exchange did 5 years ago.
But who could chase it out? Would the city go after it, or would that have to be private vigilantes?
No, I don't know. You'd have to go back through the history and see how they chased it out of Morrison and Bixby and Emmeline several years ago. But basically, the city said, no, you can't do needle exchange at Morrison and Bixby because it was in the city. They don't really certify a needle exchange or a syringe exchange program, is what the state calls it. That's entirely up to the state to certify exchange programs. But the city took it upon themselves to prohibit our exchange from working at Morrison and Bixby.
Is that still happening? Is that prohibition still in force?
As far as I know, we haven't got that. The Santa Cruz Syringe Access, which is what it was then, doesn't operate anymore. Anyway, that's what I know.
So, what is your sense about the City Council's current HaHa majority? Are they likely to have a 4-majority to at least block this if somebody attempts to, or more to overturn it?
Oh, I don't have any idea. I doubt very much that you would find a majority support on council.
And you think you would find 3 members?
I think you'd find 3.
And you might find
the obvious 3.
Right.
Try to convince Justin that it's a good idea. You might have 4.
Do you have any sense of conversations with him?
I have not.
Okay. Before I recognize you, Greg, let me just ask you, Steve, we're talking about some kind of an action in support of this. You say that the discussion closes for the
supplemental
open comment. And when, after that, how long before they make a decision?
I don't really have any idea.
Okay,
it's
so
it's a government, it's a California bureaucracy, so, you know, it could take 30 days, could take 60, could take 90, all of those times.
In that interim, will Needle Exchange continue to do its operating?
As far as I know.
And you work with Needle Exchange?
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
They'll still be out in Harvey West on Sunday nights at 6 o'clock or 7 o'clock.
And is that the only place?
They're in an exchange in Watsonville, too, but I'm not really sure where.
Are you getting any hassle from Take Back Santa Cruz types?
No.
Okay.
Yep.
Tuesday night?
The corner of Coral and Limehill. Is that what it is,
Coral and Limehill? Yeah, in Harvey West. Unless they're also doing it in Harvey West. But as far as I'm aware, we are only at the corner of Coral and Limehill.
Okay, can you call me to get new information on that, Elliot?
I mean, I'm there every weekend.
Right, but if there's also Harvey West, it's fine.
Oh, yeah, if
yeah.
There is.
And you too,
that.
Steve, if you get more information.
Okay.
Appreciate that.
Over there.
I think Greg and then you, Angel. Greg?
I'm not sure what the current status is. In terms of, is it going to be pushed more towards the Needle Exchange or a total cancellation? I mean, you know, because I was able to get hundreds, one-for-one exchange with a maximum of 15, or...
How is the
application is not for one-to-one, it's for one-to-one plus, because that's what best practices are.
Right.
When Denise and the folks collect needles on a Sunday night, or when we used to go to Russ Camp, she would take those to the county, and she could only exchange one for one with the county. So however many needles she collected at Russ Camp, she could get that many needles from the county. You can't go to the county and ask them for needles, they won't give them to you.
Okay.
You have to exchange. That's what exchange means.
Our needle is 50 cents each,
yeah,
by the way.
But
functionally, if you are a person going to Denise's Needle Exchange...
Needles at pharmacies for 50 cents, as some people claim on the internet who are anti-needle people.
Yeah, I do hate getting stuck.
Greg, if that's true, you can buy a needle for 50 cents at a pharmacy. Does anybody know? Anybody know? Nobody knows. Okay, maybe I'll look into it. What the cost is.
Destroy the market.
Bill, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, I don't know if this is relevant or not, but I just know that some work there's been a group that's been going to Bellevelson that's been trying to do like a needle exchange program kind of thing up there. Mm-hmm. And there's a group that's in opposition to that already that Connor's selling bringing back to Bellevelson.
I think I've heard of both those groups, and I think one of them is Steve's group. Steve, your group has been visiting Felton as well, right? Needle Exchange group has been visiting Felton, or one Denise has been involved in that.
I don't know whether Denise has gone to Felton or not. Not to my knowledge.
Because there's some controversy up in Felton. An opposition group, as Angel has pointed out, forming is mentioned in a Felton newspaper.
Oh, I'm sure there's opposition groups.
Exactly.
Santa Cruz, the Scotts Valley City Council just voted unanimously.
Right.
Against Needle Exchange. So it's a secondary exchange.
Does that mean that there's actually going to be prosecution of people up there?
Don't know how that plays out.
Yeah, but as far as you know, people who are doing your kind of work aren't going up there specifically.
As far as I know, I don't know anybody who is. I don't know everybody that's...
I understand.
Doing it.
Okay. So is there anything... I just wanted to bring that up. Do you want any support in this regard, Steve? Do you think the group wants any support from groups like us?
You have to ask Denise, really. She's the one that's really... She submitted the application. She's been doing all the work. She's been the spokesperson for it. So I don't want to speak for her.
And we're talking about Denise Elrick, who's the... who's trying to get a... past the local certification stuff that is heavily influenced by anti-needle people like Chief Mills, Sheriff Hart, Take Back Santa Cruz, and so forth. Well, for that matter, Captain Harold Laubach of the Salvation Army, who does not allow needle exchange inside the River Street campground or any of his other Salvation Army places.
Do you have her phone number?
For Denise?
Uh-huh.
I do, and I have to figure out where...
But I think we're going to leave it there. I was also thinking to try to get together a debate between the folks who favor an expanded needle exchange and those who want to cut it back. And so far, I haven't yet reached out to essentially the Take Back Santa Cruz folks, because I thought I would meet them at the Tuesday West Side Neighbors meeting that won't be happening until next Tuesday at the police department at 5 o'clock on the 28th of May, for those who want to go and check out the West Side Neighbors attack on RV livers, or RV inhabitants, residents. That was a song by a bunch of singers that got together: Janelle Monáe, Deep Cotton, Saint Beauty, Jadena, Roman, Gian Arthur, George 2.0, Hail You Talk About, or Are You Talking About? And of course, it names people killed, black folks killed by the police in the last 5 or 6 years, maybe a little longer. Walter Scott, Jermaine Reed, Philip White, Eric Garner, Trayvon Martin, Sean Bell, Freddie Gray, Eliana Jones, Sandra Bland, Kamani Gray, John Crawford, Michael Browns, Miriam Carey, Sharonda Singleton, Emmett Till, that's an old name, Tommy Yancey, Jordan Baker, and Amadou Diallo from 1999, shot 42 times in New York by the NYPD. YouTube video is much more graphic, has a lot more video impact, and shows you a lot more, as well as blasting the names across the screen so you can see the spelling of the name and the police doing the shooting. Now it's off to the Red Church, where we're going to check out some of the voices of the folks in line. Started out kind of limited in the number of folks who were there, and the number grew until the line went all the way back to the second door, which is three quarters of the way around the room.
So we're talking with
Thomas.
And Thomas, what you got?
Well, yesterday, Sunday, I
I didn't get enough sleep the night before, so I was heading over to Loudoun Nelson Park to take a nap. And it was about noon because it had been raining all morning, and I was kind of staying under awnings on Pacific. But it started clearing up around noon, and I went over to Loudoun Nelson. And I discovered that they were having some kind of little mini carnival for the kids, and they were setting up a band stage and everything. So I thought, okay, I'll go to Depot Park instead. But I was so tired that when I walked back around to the front on Central Street, you know, those two little benches that are out front, I stopped to sit for a minute. And no sooner did I stop than here comes the blue shirt rent-a-cop guy. And, excuse me, sir, you're going to have to move on. And I go, why? And he goes, well, somebody back there is saying that there's a homeless guy out here, and I just got really pissed off, and so so I said, well, what is their problem? I mean, why don't they have the balls to come out here and talk to me themselves, you know, and find out that I'm actually a real person who doesn't even smoke tobacco anymore, let alone crack or anything else, and I'm not out here leering at their children or anything else. I'm just tired. I'm sitting down on a bench for a minute. On my way to Depot Park, I didn't say exactly all this, but basically this is the gist of it. And he was giving me plenty of room to vent, and all along saying, I understand, you know, I have to do this all the time. He was actually on my side, and he was a young guy, Mexican man, and I thought, okay, this guy, he's just trying to pay his bills. And he was really cool, and he let me vent, and when I was done, I just said, thank you, have a good day, and I went on.
And where was this bench?
Right in front of the doors, the front doors at Loudoun Nelson. Right there on
it's
Central.
The community center, you have a right to sit there.
Yeah, I know. That's what I told him. And when he said, you're going to have to move, I said, no, I'm going to just sit here.
Did you stay?
I sat there for a minute, and I kept, you know, going on about it. And I was waiting for him to say, well, I'm going to have to call the cops, but he never said that.
Did he move on, or did he stay there?
No, he stayed and let me talk, and he was actually, you know, really, I was pleasantly surprised. He was a really...
He didn't leave you alone afterward. He stayed until you left.
Yeah, he did, actually. I did get up and start leaving right about the same time that he started walking away. Sort of.
Because you felt like leaving, or because you felt
yeah.
you were pressed
to leave? I was getting ready to leave in the first place before he even got there.
So you've actually accomplished your purpose.
Yeah, yeah. I actually took extra time away from my would-be getting ready to take a nap time to try to educate this young man. So, and
you weren't even paid to do it.
No, I wasn't even paid to do it.
And we've been talking with?
Thomas.
Who else? Thank you, Thomas.
Thank you.
Talking with?
Ricardo Lopez.
Do you have another report about our friends, the Rangers?
Yeah, they're just, they're really into, like, harassment mode. They're really harassing people, and I'm beating the bushes, you know, for people. And I just really wonder where they're getting all this extra money and priority to go around. I always tell them, you have such an important job. You know, chasing me and one homeless girl out of you know, someplace far away, up deep in the bushes, and they can't.
What was your last contact with them?
Yesterday, as they ran down to try and get me to go back and get some stuff that was wet out. And he said, he was going to carry it out. And I said, oh, that's what your threat is? You're going to steal my stuff? He says, well, if it's wet, I'll have to throw it away. And I wanted to say, why don't you just say if it's worth less than $100, it's considered trash, you know?
What was the stuff he was talking about?
Sleeping stuff that I would have, it wasn't that wet. I would sleep in it, you know? Plus, a bunch of sleeping bags, you can, if they're good, then you can sleep in them when they're wet, and you'll just dry them out.
And did he end up taking the stuff?
No, he just... talked a good game, but he didn't really want to put the backbone into it. Of course, they have to climb over they're log jams that we have. If you're light enough, you can walk over them. But they broke right through the first time the man rangers came over. The women rangers can walk over them. They're light enough, yeah. And they're like stairs, you know. You can just walk on them. But if you're too heavy, you'll fall through. And the boy rangers have to navigate it, you know. So he wasn't going to go out there in the rain and get the stuff. And yet he's telling me to go do it, you know. It's ridiculous. Yeah.
Have you heard any other encounters with these folks?
Oh, everybody's been having, like, one of my friends, they really harassed her. They gave her a ticket and then came back just quickly right after that, gave her another ticket for, and set her a court date for a misdemeanor. And, the stay away orders. And plus, it's an island in the middle of the river. Isn't that federal territory?
I don't know.
You know? I don't think they really have jurisdiction there,
If you find out more, let me know.
I will. I'd be glad to.
And, of course, we're talking with
Ricardo Lopez.
Thank you, Ricardo.
Thank you.
Thermia. People almost freezing to death last night of hypothermia. This is fascist crimes against humanity by the police department in City Hall. Everybody can see that with their ass cold. I see it every day. They throw you out of jail without a blanket, and they beat you down, take you into jail. And, that's what I'm looking at. That's crimes against the United States of America, civil rights, human rights, constitutional rights. Everybody can see that. When I swore to protect the flag as a citizen of the United States, that means that's my duty to do so.
And we've been listening to the thoughts of
Tony McDonough.
Who else?
Who's been arrested falsely and falsely imprisoned with police brutality.
Any hassles recently?
No, they've been ignoring me for some reason.
Isn't that good?
I haven't filed a lawsuit against them for, breaking my arm and all that stuff. The taxpayers, they bring us everything we need. They take away our blankets, our sleepbags, and the community being back to us, especially the Rangers. You know that. Everybody can see that.
I keep getting told.
You can see it. I see it every day. But not as much as before because they got their backs up against the wall. What I'd like to see is a rope around their neck like we did to the fascists in Germany. To Mussolini, Portugal, did to the communists.
Thank you,
Overnight. Tony.
Take care, man.
When a council member says, don't work against us, work with us, there's something wrong. That council member is missing something very important. During the years that the city raided the encampments of the homeless, continuously confiscating their possessions, which left them exposed to the elements, it was the homeless who were saying, hey, work with us, not against us. We're human beings, not aliens. We're part of your society. The city's response was to hold another raid a few weeks later. It never seemed to get enough of its ability to add torment to those who had already been in most dire circumstances. The only thing that stopped the raids was compensation of goods with the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals. I'm going to skip here. The city just doesn't seem to know how to stop tormenting people. Yet the city council wants self-respecting human beings who still have real human feelings in their hearts to work with them. First, the city must show that it can actually stop working against the people. This is an open letter that I just picked up on Facebook from a guy named Steve Martinot, Martinot, dated today, on working with and working against. Open letter to the mayor and city council on Facebook.
Which Facebook page?
Marcia Poole posted it, but he does go on and nails them in a similar manner about every corrupt thing that they've been doing in the name of do it our way without ever listening to what their citizens want. And it's worth reading.
And we've been listening to the oratory of...
Oh, I'm just another domestic terrorist, that's all.
Domestic terrorist number 10. Thank you, sir. Say that again.
The only thing that's sad to me is that people don't have a dry place to stay, like an awning or something they can stay underneath and not get hassled. It's really sad to see that. I'm lucky I have a car, but a lot of people out there are struggling.
And your name is?
Gregory.
And Gregory, have you been hassled in your car?
No.
Good. How long you been in town?
3 years.
Hey, good work.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks, Gregory. Any reports?
Or the police probably saying I didn't see any incidents.
That's good.
They had control of most situations.
And you want to say your first name?
My first name is Eric with the C.
Thank you, Eric.
Oh, Rocky. Thank you for the dinner.
Yeah, I didn't do it.
All right.
I'm just wandering around.
Not really. Jax?
sucks.
Oh, Jack.
They've been discriminating.
Tell me about that.
And telling us that we can order their food, but we can't eat inside. And when we asked them to explain themselves, they said it was policy. And then they eventually asked us not to come back. We're not allowed on their property anymore.
When did this happen?
On Sunday.
And it took them forever to tell us why we couldn't be in there. We kept asking, like, why, and he said, well, let me make this, or sorry. He kept putting it off.
He stated over and over again, it's policy. It's our policy. If you stay, we can call the cops. So I kept asking. Finally, they started making excuses. Well, the smell. Not a specific smell, but the smell.
I don't smell nothing.
I took a shower yesterday. What are you talking about, the smell? Mm-hmm. So then they said, well, it's alcohol. Like, they didn't see any containers or anything. They're all of a sudden saying...
You were intoxicated, were you?
No, they said, it's not you. It's some other people in your group. So all of you are not allowed to sit in here.
Well, we're just being cautious, you see.
I said we're spending our money just like any other customer, and those customers get to stay.
They waited to take the money before they said this to us.
So wait a minute. So you were a customer, and then they tried to
we were paying customers.
$40.
And that happened to you, too.
Yes.
So want to give your name for free radio?
Eileen.
David.
And if you got contact information, if you give it to me, I'll get back to you. Because we had this problem with Jack's 10 years ago. We did a protest out front. They changed their policy.
Okay.
Now, apparently, they're fucking up again.
Also, Tish, she made a video on her phone, so she should have interviews from us as well.
Your name again?
Eileen.
And?
David.
Thank you both. I'm sorry this shit happened to you.
Life has been great. I'm here to continue.
And if you have a musical instrument on your back.
Yeah.
Have you been playing outside?
Oh, yeah, every day.
And are you getting a good income?
It's never easy.
And are you being hassled by any police?
No,
rangers?
Police have been cool, and the rangers have been just as cool. A lot less problems lately. It's been nice.
How long have you been doing this?
Probably almost my whole life.
And in Santa Cruz?
All over the world.
How recently in Santa Cruz?
Last 15 years.
And we've been talking with?
Jeff.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you. You say, you know, everybody that's on SSI, SSD, okay, how come they made it so hard for them to deal with a lost card? How come they make it so hard for somebody, you know, that's in that position to make a phone call? Well, we got at least two van services in this town that don't belong. One's right next to the laundromat on Mission Street where the old, where there was another, there's a closed store or closed place we used to eat, and it's right there in front, and it shows just right, like plain as day, but nobody ever notices. Thank you.
And we've been talking with
Gregory.
Thanks, Gregory. Anything you want to say yourself?
I didn't go last Wednesday because it's raining. What happened last Wednesday? It's kind of been chaotic the last couple weeks.
It was pretty chaotic. I definitely got a lot of reports. Grab me later when I'm not doing this. Kim, any?
And I apologize for some of the fragmentary quality of some of these reports, but people are in line, they're about to get food, they have to sign in for food, people behind them are impatient to get into the get to the food while it lasts, because it doesn't last, it gets all eaten up, and so we get fragments of time, so there you are.
Your reports for the radio
show. I was thinking about starting Food Not Bombs in Asheville, North Carolina, but I don't have any money.
I hear you, babe. Any reports from the street? Thank you. Any street reports? Any reports from the street?
Rain 2020.
Okay. Say again.
The rain was fabulous. Cleaned the air all up.
It's but did really you get wet?
Yes, absolutely.
Did you get soaked?
Yeah, I had to steam dry it. Inside the bag, steam coming out.
And how long did that take?
It was about three quarters done by the morning.
Yeah, that sounds... I would hate to be in your shoes.
No, top of the link. Just remember to get inside the bag. Or you fall asleep looking at the stars. Get in the bag.
You can see the stars.
Well, so to speak. Yeah, looking out.
I would think there would be heavy clouds.
It was heavy raindrops. It was like a good, nice day in Eureka. Heavy rain.
And we've been talking with?
Blackfoot.
Your name is?
Michael.
Thank you, Michael. Anything you want to add?
Well, get some boards and suit. We're going to be at Cal's. We're going to start surfing set up a little surf corner there. So drop in if you want to try it. Try it. In the next few days, we'll see us.
Thank you, sir.
I'll talk more. All right.
Thank you, Michael. Yeah.
The police need to back off a little bit.
And what's happened to your
parking tickets and harassment of just being on the street?
And when was the last time you got such a ticket?
3 days ago. Yesterday. Yeah, panhandling, $50, $5 in gas. Figure that one out.
Wow. Where did you get the ticket?
By the 76 station in Midtown.
What police agency gave it to you? Do you remember?
Santa Cruz Police.
What did they say to you?
He said, I was on the sidewalk. He said, I'm not allowed to be panhandling. And he gave me a ticket for it.
It is legal to ask for money. There are limitations, supposedly, severe restrictions, but you shouldn't be. There's no blanket ban on panhandling. So, go ahead. So we've been talking with
Rob.
Thank you, man. Gotcha. Anything you want to say for free radio?
No, I'm just too tired tonight.
Okay, man. Get some rest. And I've already talked to you.
Yes, sir.
Any reports for free radio?
And we'll be returning to the Red Church probably on Sunday, at least to this bunch of Red Church interviews. But here's an interview with a poet up in Felton that I ran into at the White Raven Cafe, who has written a poem or two that I wanted him to read, and so he did.
It's close to 2 o'clock, and I'm here in the White Raven Cafe on May 19th, and I'm talking with
Ron Lampe.
And Ron, you went to your car and pulled out this original draft, or it looks like a corrected draft, of a poem you wrote inspired by the Ross Camp?
Yes, that's correct, yes. When I saw it for the first time from the intersection of Highway 1 and River Street, I was taken aback. I mean, I had all these impressions come to me, and so I wrote this short poem simply titled Tents.
Get it.
Tents. Night. It's chilly. Light rainy. It's miserable to be outside. Who'd want to be outside in a night like this? What is that? What is going on there? You're driving by Highway 1 at River Street and squeeze behind the Gateway Plaza alongside the highway up against the San Lorenzo levee. What was that? What mirage was that? Tents? There must have been 100 of them. Tents. Small, in rows. Shiny wet. You could make out a few colors in the dark. Tents? In this weather? And all this winter season? How is it possible to live like that? A whole tent encampment is out there in the night, in this inhospitable night, in the cold, in the rain. Who are these people who can settle into such a night? The homeless, the Santa Cruz homeless. It's the homeless encampment, the so-called Tent City. And Santa Cruz wants to do something about it. Like what? Where can these people go? What is happening here, Santa Cruz? And not only in Santa Cruz, what is happening here? America. America, how can this be? You are America the wealthy. America the bountiful. America the great. America the moral leader. America, protector of its citizens. Yes. No.
And again, the name of the poem, Ron?
Is simply Tents.
And we're listening to the poetry of
Ron Lampe.
Thank you, Ron.
You're welcome, Robert.
So we got a long Food Not Bombs poem, so just grab your coffee.
Hey, this is a long poem.
Well, start at the beginning. I'll see how tired I get.
I know what it stops. I know it.
Food Not Bombs. Yeah. Why are all these people gathered there? Well, they're hungry. Hanging from the trunk of a sycamore tree, a sign you will see, Food, Not Bombs. And it's every Saturday and Sunday, 4 to 6 p.m., You'll see them lined up and gathered there. Food Not Bombs sets up at the corner, Water and Front Streets, alongside the downtown Santa Cruz post office, and offers freely and compassionately, no one turned away, deliciously and genuinely healthy food to the homeless and hungry, feeding those in need, and doing so at the same location ever since the Occupy movement of 2011. And line up they do, down the sidewalk, going even beyond the iron pointy fence that is now a permanent imposing painted fence the city felt it had to put up to protect the PO at over 100 years old. It is listed in the National Register of Historic Places. As up to 300 people can show up for a meal over the 2 days. They patiently wait in line, holding big, compostable, hard paper bowls, queuing up to long white folding tables under a big white portable canopy, these silver hotel trays packed with food, 8 servers scooping out great tasting vegan dishes. After all, it's all cooked at India Joe's. It has to be good. And I can attest, I indulged a bit myself. There's variety, there's bean chowder, fresh produce, baked goodies, breads cut up, and a water dispenser. They all load up and chow down sitting along the fence or on the lower PO steps or wherever there's enough of a ledge to sit and eat. And a few of the inner circle of friends sit on folding chairs around the literature table. Friendly Keith McHenry, point man for this local chapter of Food Not Bombs, among them. Bicycles, shopping carts, skateboards, day packs, big black bags of personal life belongings that have been wheeled around are parked along the fence all around the area. A guitar or two is strummed by someone or another. A joint or two is lit up. Small conversations, but more so silent, private, focusing on eating. A woman paces around, oblivious to others, talking to strips of paper she constantly throwing down on the pavement. And a few latecomers are still showing up. I came with a camera and realized the sensitivity of the scene. But street photography I had already been doing a while, and so I was aware. And I met Keith McHenry when I first arrived. He happens to be an original co-founder with 7 other anti-nuclear activists of Food Not Bombs back in Boston in 1980 when he was a Boston University student. He saw so much good organic produce from the health food store he worked at tossed out and wasted. What a terrible shame that was. So he thought of sharing it with those going without, starting at the local public housing project. Why not? And it so happened across the street from it, believe it or not, had gone up a new weapons lab in the U.S. Intercontinental Nuclear Bomb Program, which made him so immediately aware of the menace of nuclear weapons and nuclear power. And he and his activist friends said something like, why not offer food rather than bombs? So Food Not Bombs was born, and so they distributed food to various housing projects and then offered food, even cooked meals, directly on the street. Keith himself had gone through a homeless period in the 70s, so he had firsthand experience of what it was like. And at some point in the 80s, he migrated to San Francisco and helped start up another Food Not Bombs group. The homeless situation was in SF was well known and definitely escalating. And for the good work of feeding the homeless there, but without a permit, they started getting arrested. The first arrest, including McHenry, occurred at Golden Gate Park, August 15, 1988. And over the years, as Food Not Bombs chapters popped up across the country, their volunteers have been arrested for the simple act of feeding the hungry thousands of times. In Santa Cruz, a chapter was founded in 1992 by Kim Argula, Robert Flory, and Tony Mello. And Keith McHenry came down to the cruise and is today spokesperson for our local Food Not Bombs. Something like 38 years he's been dedicated to feeding the homeless and hungry. Locally, he's been butting heads with the city and a few residents who take issue with feeding the homeless in this way. As they say, eyesore messy, open public way. But as Keith says, we can end homelessness if we divert some of the billions spent for war on real national security of jobs, affordable housing, education, and health care. Blaming the homeless for their condition is clearly not working. Food Not Bombs is now active in 1,000 cities in 65 countries. And every Saturday and Sunday, 4 to 6 p.m., they come for the nourishment of good food. Good food served up with compassion.
And the name of the poem again?
Food Not Bombs.
And indeed, tomorrow, Friday the 24th, as I think I mentioned earlier, Food Not Bombs has its 39th anniversary soup stock at the Resource Center for Nonviolence. And it's a $5 to $20 sliding scale. Or come on in if you ain't got anything and just be there. That's going to start at 6. It's again 612 Ocean Street. I think I said 610 before, my mistake. And as I mentioned before, DNA, Gina Wren, Danny Paul Nelson, Robert Perala, Raging Grannies, and Lyrical Eye will be there. Food Not Bombs will be celebrating. I'm reading from the Indie Bay pronouncement. 39 years of feeding social movements and the hungry at the Soupstock Festival. The 20th anniversary Soupstock featured Fugazi and Slater Kinney and drew nearly 20,000 people. With nearly a billion people going hungry every day, how can we spend another dollar on war? Food Not Bombs is an all-volunteer movement, again reads the Indie Bay announcement, that recovers and shares free vegan or vegetarian food with the public without restriction in over 1,000 cities in 65 countries around the world to protest war, poverty, and the destruction of the environment. Each group is independent, invites everyone to participate in making decisions for their chapter using the consensus process. You know, I'm going to skip the advertisements. You can go online and read it. You can talk to Keith and other activists who are doing it about it by either going to Soupstock tomorrow at 5 or going to the meal 4 to 6 Saturday and Sunday over the weekend, or showing up to help serve free food at the Front Street Kitchen where they prepare it for 18 Front or thereabouts. It's at India Joe's restaurant. So if you want to help out in any of those ways or volunteer to either serve or cook or distribute literature or help organize or back homeless civil rights, and that's what we do at HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, you can come to those events for the Food Not Bombs connection, or you can get in touch with us at 423-HUFF, 423-4833. It's also meeting time for us noon every Wednesday, and 11 o'clock the hour before, it's Conscience in Action, which is a similarly involved group, mostly many of the same people and much of the same objectives, all at the Sub Rosa Cafe next to the bike church at 703 Pacific. And that's about it for this edition of Bathroom Spears Broadsides. I want to thank you for being with me, and hopefully you'll actually go out there and do something yourselves, which may involve stopping and observing police officers harassing a homeless person, or maybe you don't know if they're harassing. Maybe they're just talking to someone. But if you show up, get close enough to hear, pull out your camera or your phone, take a few pictures, it's not going to hurt anybody that you do that. And it may help. And if you find something that's worth passing on, post it on YouTube and give me a call at 423-4833. HUF is looking for volunteers. If you're interested, 423-4833, again, is the number to call if you want to be a part of HUF. And also Free Radio is looking for all kinds of stuff, people, equipment, funding, and also a place to set up a studio, 10 by 10 space with access to electricity, internet, bathroom. We pay you $300 as a finder's fee if you find it. And we also give you a hearty hug for doing that, because we need a place. And you can call me and let me know any tips, or you can go to the Free Radio website at freakradio.org. That's it for this edition. Talk to you again, well, when you listen.